I'm Christopher Granger. I'm a cardiologist at Duke University and am delighted to be joined today for this podcast by Jennifer Green, who's an endocrinologist who works with us on the intersection of cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes. She's been very involved both in trials generating evidence for the effects of new treatments as well as how we implement treatments. And Jennifer, I'm really happy to have you in this discussion today, because you're the person that I look to as the endocrinologist who I think maybe best understands of anybody that I know how to partner with cardiology and advise cardiologists on how to safely use, especially these new drugs. The care issues are much broader than the drugs themselves. But today, let's focus on the role of the drugs that have been proven to have cardiovascular benefit, SGLT2 inhibitors, GLP-1 receptor agonists, that we know are being underused, and they're not being used very often at all by cardiologists. And how can you advise our cardiology colleagues on what their role might be in the use of these drugs?
Thanks, Chris. I'm really happy to be here today. And this is really important subject matter. And I think you've touched on a couple of key issues when it comes to delivery of guideline-based care for our patients. And I think first, the health of people with diabetes, particularly people with diabetes and cardiovascular complications, it really doesn't belong to any one specialty or group of doctors. And it's a shared responsibility. And it's important for us to look across sort of the broad spectrum of how our patients are being treated so that we can optimize their health moving forward. And I think, that may be a very different perspective on care for lots of different types of specialists. I think it can be helpful to think about some of these drugs that were developed to treat diabetes as something different or something more, and drugs that are really improving cardiovascular health and often cardiorenal health that have a nice sort of added benefit of lowering glucose for people who may need that effect as well.
So you're almost describing these, for many patients at least, as primarily cardiovascular drugs, not really primarily to control the blood sugar.
I think it's helpful to think of them in that fashion. We know that in certain circumstances and situations that glucose lowering itself can help reduce cardiovascular risk, but that's probably only true over the very long term. And what's been very exciting for me is to see that some of these newer classes, particularly the SGLT2 inhibitors, reduce the risk of important cardiovascular outcomes within a very short time frame of use. So yes, we really need to think about these drugs as being very powerful means of reducing cardiovascular risks in patients with diabetes, and now it looks like in people without diabetes as well.
Well, that's a great point. And why don't we start out, because I think the SGLT2s are the drugs that are probably the easier ones for a cardiologist to use. But there are some really important issues to use them, safely and in the appropriate population. And if you could just highlight a few of the key messages to our cardiology colleagues.
Sure. And I would agree. I think the SGLT2 inhibitors are easy for everyone to use. And these are drugs that essentially cause you to excrete more glucose in the urine. There's an osmotic diuretic effect that occurs as a result of that, and also due to increased sodium excretion as well. So just remember, if you're seeing a little frail older person who has a soft blood pressure, somebody who's already on a lot of diuretics, just know that there will be a modest additional diuretic effect when you add an SGLT2 inhibitor. So in certain cases, you may wish to reduce the doses of their other diuretic or diuretics or their other antihypertensives, maybe just as you're adding the SGLT2 inhibitor, just until you are able to determine the effect of the new drug on their volume status and blood pressure. But to be honest, in many trials where these drugs were added, there were no changes to the patient's background therapies. And so it may not be entirely mandatory to do that, but we can always introduce a bit of common clinical sense into use of these newer drugs.
I was just going to ask about the patients with renal impairment, how you think about them.
Well, these drugs, for the most part, can be used on label in patients with an EGFR down to 45. But as you know, in many of the cardiovascular outcomes trials and now in trials of patients with chronic kidney disease, these drugs in general, the SGLT2 inhibitors, appear to have very significant positive benefits on both renal function over time in patients with diabetes and chronic kidney disease, and cardiovascular outcomes in those patients as well. So I think we're learning more about our ability to use these drugs safely in patients with lower EGFR values. And in fact, canagliflozin is now indicated for use down to an EGFR of 30 in patients with diabetes and chronic kidney disease and a significant amount of albuminuria. So we'll probably see that needle moving a bit lower moving forward.
And how about this rare but important complication of DKA with normal blood sugar?
Right. So there is a condition called euglycemic DKA. It's a bit of a misnomer because usually the glucose isn't totally normal, but it might not be as high as you'd expect to see in traditional DKA. Now, fortunately, in people with type 2 diabetes, DKA in the setting of SGLT2 inhibitor use is rare, but it can happen. It's important to, in a patient with the right symptoms, abdominal pain, confusion, the right clinical scenario, such as an infection, to have a reasonably high level of suspicion. And so rather than relying on the blood glucose or ketones in the urine, in someone like that, it's best to check chemistries to measure the anion gap and check serum ketones or serum beta hydroxybutyrate if you're worried about DKA in an SGLT2 inhibitor user. Now, we're fortunate in that there have been recent recommendations made by the FDA and other groups suggesting ways of mitigating that risk of DKA in SGLT2 inhibitor users. And it's pretty much common sense. If you have a patient who becomes very ill for other reasons, someone who can't eat or drink because they're in the hospital or they have a major surgery planned, it's a good idea to hold the drug, maybe even several days in advance if you know about that procedure, and then only to restart it once the patient is back to normal and eating and drinking normally. And that probably will go a very long way towards reducing the likelihood of that already rare occurrence from happening.
Good. And Jennifer, finally for SGLT2, maybe the most important excess in terms of numerical excess, there is this growing yeast infection. And what would you recommend around that issue?
Right. Well, this is another situation where I think education goes a long way. So when you have more glucose in your urine, if that urine sits on the perineum, for example, we know that the risk of genitourinary infections is higher. And so taking just a few moments to talk with patients about that and to encourage good perineal hygiene, such as bathing every day and making sure that they dry the area well after urinating, probably, again, can mitigate the risk of GU infections pretty significantly. Now, I will avoid use of SGLT2 inhibitors in patients who simply can't perform that independently. So someone who is immobilized, someone who has urinary incontinence, probably isn't a great candidate for an SGLT2 inhibitor for that reason alone.
And Jennifer, the other class of drugs then are the injectable agents, GLP-1 receptor agonists, at least with the exception of oral semaglutide, which hasn't yet gone through the trials to show cardiovascular benefit. So, but for these drugs, who would you consider to be like the ideal candidate for a GLP-1 receptor agonist?
Right. Great question. And, we need to learn more about the optimal choice between SGLT2 inhibitors versus GLP-1 receptor agonists in our patients with type 2 diabetes and established atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. To be honest, they both are good choices. There is some emerging data that suggests that the GLP-1 receptor agonists may be particularly good at reducing risk of cardiovascular complications in patients with multiple risk factors for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes as well. These are drugs that at present require injection either daily or weekly. And so there's a little bit of training that's involved with instructing the patient to use the device. but they're really very easy to use, and particularly with a once a week injection, can be pretty convenient for the patient, especially if they're already taking a lot of other medicines. And these are drugs that often are associated with weight loss, so that's another nice potential side effect, although it's not a guarantee for everyone. Now, when I am starting someone on a GLP-1 receptor agonist, I know that in 25 to 30% of people who start these medicines, there may be some GI side effects and nausea, maybe vomiting, and in some people, loose stools can be an early side effect. But if it's mild, usually with continued use, the side effects will lessen or completely disappear. And there are some tips and tricks to minimizing the likelihood that someone will have GI intolerance. I tell people that it does slow their stomach emptying. And so it, particularly when they're first starting the medicine or up titrating the dose, they should avoid eating very large meals at any one time and spread their food intake out throughout the day to up their chances of being able to tolerate the drug successfully. And fortunately, most people can take these drugs without difficulty.
Well, Jennifer, that was terrific. Thank you so much for sharing, especially the practical advice around safe and appropriate use of these drugs. And thank you, and have a nice day.
Thank you.